Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Geoffrey Matthews reads the second of 10 episodes.
In May 1931, Hugh Conway and three other people were being evacuated by air from a trouble spot in northwest India. On the way, they discovered that their pilot was unknown to them and that they were off course. They landed in wild country. Strange tribesmen prevented them from getting out. The plane's tanks were filled, and the machine took off again for an unknown destination. The most extraordinary business. Mallinson, Conway's junior in the consulate they were leaving, developed the theory that they were being kidnapped for ransom. "That sort of trick is by no means new," he told the others. "Though this particular technique is certainly original. There have been plenty of kidnappings before. A good many of them have ended up all right. The tribesmen keep you in some lair in the mountains until relatives or friends pay up. You're treated quite decently, I gather."
Barnard, the American, wasn't particularly impressed with this theory.
"Well, gentlemen, I dare say this is a cute idea on somebody's part, but I can't exactly figure your Air Force has covered itself with glory. It's had one of its aircraft stolen from under its nose. And, by the way, I should like to know what this fellow did with a real pilot."
Conway agreed, tentatively, with Mallinson's kidnapping theory. He also agreed, to some extent, with Barnard's strictures on the Air Force. "Though one can see, of course, how it may have happened," he said. "With the place and the commotion it was during the evacuation, one man in flying kit would look very much like another. And it's pretty obvious that this fellow knows how to fly. There wouldn't have been any reason to suspect him." During this conversation, the fourth member of the party, Miss Roberta Brinkler, was sitting tight-lipped and straight-backed. She was a small, middle-aged woman, toughened after many years of missionary work in the Far East. Conway bent forward and spoke in her ear. "We seem to be in a strange fix, but I'm glad that you're taking it calmly. I don't really think anything dreadful is going to happen to us."
"I have full confidence in you, Mr. Conway. I'm sure nothing terrible will happen if you can prevent it."
All afternoon, the plane soared through the thin mists of the upper atmosphere, far too high to give clear sight of what lay beneath. Sometimes, at longish intervals, the veil was torn for a moment to display the jagged outline of a peak or the glint of some unknown river. The direction could be determined roughly from the sun. It was still east, with an occasional twist to the north. Suddenly, after they'd been flying for several hours, Mallinson leapt to his feet.
"Look here, how are we bound to sit here twiddling our thumbs while this maniac does everything he damn well wants? What's to stop us smashing that glass and having it out with him?"
"Nothing at all," said Conway, "except that he may be armed and we're not. And in any case, none of us would know how to bring the machine to Earth afterwards."
"I am right about that, aren't I? None of us can fly an aeroplane, can we?"
There was a murmur of agreement.
"All right, so none of us can fly," said Mallinson. "But this business is getting on my nerves. Can't we make the fellow come down?"
"How do you suggest it should be done?"
"Well, he's there, isn't he, about 6 feet away from us? And we're three men to one. We might at least force him to tell us what the game is."
"Very well. We'll see." Conway took a few steps forward to the glass partition and tapped on it. The response was exactly as he'd expected. The panel slid sideways, and the barrel of a revolver was pushed through. Conway retreated without arguing the point. There seemed nothing that any of them could do. Conway went back to his seat, stretched out at full length, and went to sleep. When he woke some time later, he became aware of slight dizziness and heart thumping. His chest became restricted and breathing was difficult. He looked out. The sky had cleared completely, and in the light of late afternoon, he saw a vision which for the moment snatched the remaining breath from his lungs. Far away, at the very limit of distance, lay range upon range of snow peaks, apparently floating upon vast levels of cloud. They compassed the whole arc of the circle, merging towards the west in a horizon that was fierce almost garish in colouring. One by one, the others woke up.
"You recognize where we are, Conway?"
said Barnard. "No. I've never been anywhere near here before. But I think it likely that we're still in India, and that that range of mountains over there is the Karakorams."
"Look here, Conway," said Mallinson. "We'd better drop the kidnapping theory. We're far past the frontier country by now. There aren't any tribes living round here. The fellow's a raving lunatic. Would anybody except a lunatic fly into this sort of country?"
"It's very well organized lunacy, you know," said Conway. "Don't forget the landing for petrol." And for the moment, appalling as the situation was, Conway felt he didn't want to resent anything that proceeded with such intriguing purpose. This feeling was strengthened when Miss Brinkler looked up at them and said, "It is the will of God." And there came over him, too, as he stared at those superb mountains, a glow of satisfaction that there were such places still left on earth, distant, inaccessible. Twilight fell, then suddenly night. A full moon rose, touching each peak in succession until the long horizon glittered against the blue-black sky. Mallinson began to get worried about the petrol.
"How far would full tanks have taken us, Conway?"
"About 1,000 miles. If I'm right, and these mountains are the Karakorams, we should be able to reach some part of Tibet before the petrol gives out. But we've got some time to go yet." Conway closed his eyes and went peacefully to sleep again. Bit by bit, the others dozed too. Suddenly, they were all awakened by a lurch of the machine. Conway's head struck the window. A returning lurch sent him floundering between the two tiers of seats. It was much colder. The first thing he did automatically was to glance at his watch. It showed 1:30. He must have been asleep for some time. His ears were full of a loud flapping sound. The engines had been shut off. The plane was rushing against a gale. Then he could see the earth, quite close, vague and grey, racing past underneath. Mallinson clutched at the back of a seat.
"He's going to crash! Watch out!"
The plane made brief contact with the earth, rose, fell heavily back, trundling unevenly forwards. Mallinson groaned during 10 seconds of crashing and swaying. Something was heard to strain and snap, and one of the tires exploded. The machine wheeled round and came to rest. Mallinson wrenched open the door and prepared to make the jump down to earth. He turned to the others.
"This looks like the end of the world."
A moment later, chilled and shivering, they all agreed with him as he left the plane. With no sound in their ears save the fierce gusts of wind and their own crunching footsteps, they felt themselves at the mercy of something savage. The moon had disappeared, and starlight lit a tremendous emptiness. Heaving with wind, a bleak world, mountain high. Mallinson was already making for the cockpit.
"I'm going to tackle him right away."
He clambered up to the cockpit, but after a few seconds dropped down again. "I say, Conway, something wrong. I think the fellow's ill or dead or something.
Come up and look. I took his revolver at any rate."
"Better give it to me," said Conway. And he hoisted himself up. Peering in, he could just see the pilot, huddled forward, his head sprawling over the controls. He shook him, unfastened his helmet, and loosened the clothes round his neck. "Yes. Something's happened to him. You must get him out." With Barnard and Mallinson helping, the pilot was taken from his seat and lifted to the ground. He was unconscious, not dead. "Possibly a heart attack," said Conway. "We can do very little for him out here. There's no shelter from this infernal wind. Better get him inside the plane, and ourselves too. Haven't an idea where we are, and it's hopeless to make a move until daylight." They carried the man into the cabin and laid him along the gangway between the seats. The interior wasn't much warmer than the outside, but at least it was a shelter from the wind. It wasn't an ordinary wind. It was like a frenzy that lived all round them, tilting the loaded machine and shaking it viciously. "His heart's very faint," said Conway. Miss Brinklow groped in her handbag.
"I wonder if this would be any use."
She held out a small bottle of brandy.
"I always carry it with me in case of accidents."
"Thank you, Miss Brinklow. Just the stuff." After a moment, the slightest movement of eyelids was visible. As Conway kept vigil throughout that gale, tormented night, he reasoned the situation out to himself. He guessed that the flight had progressed far beyond the western range of the Himalayas. If that were so, they should by now have reached the loftiest and least hospitable place on earth, the Tibetan Plateau, a vast, uninhabited, and largely unexplored region. It was probable the nearest human settlement was hundreds of miles away. They had no food. They were unarmed, except for one revolver. The aeroplane was damaged and almost fuelless. They had no clothes suited to the icy cold. In short, it was absolutely essential for the pilot to be kept alive. The night dragged on. As Conway watched in the early dawn, the valley began to take shape, revealing a floor of rock and shingle sloping upwards. At last, the sun rose into a sky of deep delphinium blue. As the air grew warmer, the others wakened, and Conway suggested carrying the pilot into the open where the sharp, dry air and the sunlight might help to revive him. This was done, and they began a second and pleasanter vigil. Eventually, the man opened his eyes and began to speak. His four passengers stooped over him, listening to sounds that were meaningless, except to Conway, who occasionally made answers. The man became weaker. Conway put the brandy bottle to his lips again, but the spirit seemed to do him no good. About the middle of the morning, he died. Conway stayed crouching by his side. Then he straightened up and joined the others.
"I'm sorry to say he told me very little," he said, "merely that we were in Tibet. I didn't understand him very well, but he said something about a lamasery near here, a sort of Buddhist monastery where we could get food and shelter. Shangri-La, he called it. There seems to be an obvious way along the valley, but let's hope it's not halfway up that mountain." Conway's remarks served to fix their attention on a glittering cone-shaped peak towards which the valley pointed, and then their gaze turned to a stair. They could see, far away, approaching them down the slope, the figures of men. And as the figures moved down the valley, they revealed themselves to be a party of a dozen or more, carrying with them a hooded chair.
That was episode 2 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton. It was read by Jeffrey Matthews.